Law and Disorder, the podcast that gets real with addiction, recovery, and everything in between. Hear the 360 degrees with your hosts, Tim,
Disorder,
and Joe,
Law,
with guest speakers specializing in every field related to why you just tuned in. Welcome to Law and Disorder. And remember, recovery is possible. Tim and Joe, it's all yours.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. I'm Tim.
And I'm Joe.
We want you to know that we're all over social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And if you want to listen to our podcast, you can find us all over the place there as well. We're on Anchor, Buzzsprout, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. And if you'd like to support us and our goal to spread a message of hope, and that message is recovery is possible, you can find us on Patreon. So we're going to have a guest in a little while, but before we get to her, there is something that Joe and I talked about a bit off air that Joe feels kind of strongly about. So I'm going to throw it to him and let him just share his thoughts.
So as we're developing our podcast and kind of reaching out to other recovery groups, kind of networking, I guess you could say, some of the things that came across as peculiar were there is like no like central hub where, let's say, somebody needs some help and they do not know where to get it, right, locally.
Right.
So they're reaching out and it's like playing phone tag with everybody, right? But sure. Nobody's it.
Right.
So it's kind of just a vicious circle.
Right.
So what we're looking at is we had an inmate, he got released prior to him being able to get the Vivitrol injection. And that was due to the blood work that had to be done was not done in time. Obviously, we were kind of projecting his outdate to be about 2 weeks later than it was. So our medical staff at the jail, she brings it up to my attention. She says, okay, I'm really irritated and I need you to do something about this, right? So... because I kind of oversee them and help them along getting things done.
Right.
Yeah. So she says she spent two hours digging for phone numbers and resources to get this gentleman hooked up where he could, you know, continue along the path that he had his mind set. And he went to every Vivitrol orientation. He went to all of our classes. And he was ready, right? He told me, I am mentally ready
this time. Just wanted to be pointed in the right direction.
Yes, a simple process.
You would think.
So she reaches out to, and this is a neighboring county, okay? We're talking maybe a 45-minute drive from one facility to the next, right?
Right.
So we're not talking halfway across the world or the country or even the state. So she's on the phone 2 hours, digging around. She's looking on the web. While she's waiting on hold in these different facilities and whatnot. And he's standing behind her and he kind of chuckled. And she turned around, she's like, what's so funny? And he's like, well, I'm not being rude by any means, but welcome to my world. This is what I go through.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been there as an addict where you know there's help out there, but you don't know where to go to get it, right? You don't just call 911. There's no, hey, if you're an addict, you call 511 instead.
Right.
Which actually would kind of make sense.
Oh, it would definitely make sense. Like, they don't know where to reach out to.
Right.
And then if you're in a moment of, like, I don't know, like, desperation, like, okay, you've hit a point where you're like, I need help, right?
Sure.
And you don't know where to get that help. It's kind of like, you know, it's a slap in the face.
What's even worse, and I've said for a while, I don't know if this is the case today, but... when you want to go to rehab, you're prepared to go to rehab, you need to have the ability to do that immediately because addicts will change their mind. If you tell them there's a bed in 2 weeks, they're probably not going.
Right. Right. No, absolutely. And I get that. So my line of thinking today was, okay, why is there not just a number someone can call? Like you mentioned, like a 511 or whatever
sure.
the case may be.
Yeah.
Where they can explain their situation, their location.
Right.
And someone says, hang on 1 second. I will connect you.
Yeah. some expert who knows the appropriate resource, right?
It, or has access to a data bank, right? So all this federal money is going to be coming down. I mean, it already is, but it's going to be more and more. So if you're receiving federal money, which most government agencies are,
right?
Why can it not be mandated they also report their contact numbers, their access lines?
Right. It makes perfect sense. And, you know, even like you said, it's a slap in the face to the addict who's seeking help that it's such a difficult task to find. As somebody who is in social work and helps people, I think I'm pretty good at connecting people to resources, but I don't always have the answers for those people who come in and want help with their substance abuse issues. It's not as easy as, say, connecting people with mental health services, right?
Right.
There's a number for that. It's called access.
Right.
It may take a minute to get where you need to go. And if it's going to take too long, then you have to examine the possibility of hospitalization, right?
Mm-hmm.
Emergency psych ward, as they say. But, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when it comes to addiction, like it doesn't work that way. There's no emergency rehab.
No.
On the corner.
And you have like a, we'll call it a millisecond just for comparison.
Right.
To get them help. And if they're reaching out and saying, I need help, there's a golden opportunity right there. And I think all family members or anybody who's ever dealt with someone going through addiction and getting them to that point where they're like, okay, yes, I need help, right?
Yeah.
That's a huge step. That's the first step, right?
Right.
Okay. So what I was kind of thinking was, why are we not, like, they have apps for everything, right?
Sure.
They could design an app. Like, so if someone's out there and techie person, right, programmer or whatever, there's your $1 million idea for you, right? Thank Joe and Tim, right?
Yeah,
and
cut us in.
And
we'll help you refine it.
Right, so Patreon is where you can
cut us in, right? Right, when you're the next Mark Zuckerberg.
Right, yeah. So my point being is Facebook tracks you, Google tracks you, I mean, it's everybody's tracking you, like Amazon tracks you.
Right.
So why is it not possible when we're sending all this information without even knowing it? Why is it not possible that we have like an app? Like if I'm going through addiction and I'm like, okay, I'm rock bottom. I need help.
I need help now.
Yeah. So I open up this app and I'm like, here's my name, my number, and boom, send my location, right?
Yeah.
And then I get a response back.
Right.
Hold tight. Someone will be there within blah, blah, blah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And there are good programs like Hope, Not Handcuffs. And those should be part of this apparatus that you're talking about. Maybe that would help those people, if not Hope, Not Handcuffs, a program like it. And it would help someone get there.
Right. And those programs are expanding due to this grant money.
Right.
Right. So so why can't we incorporate that in and make it a well-oiled machine rather than, you know, every county, every city doing different things with different numbers. And yeah, sometimes if you're not like living in that county that you're about to go to, yeah, good luck.
Yeah.
You know, it's difficult.
Well, of course this can happen. I mean, this might be an example of like, be the change you want to see, right? And hopefully it starts right here. Hopefully somebody hears what we're talking about and acts on it. If they don't, we just have to keep talking about it, right?
Right. That's what we're here for, right?
No doubt.
So if you're out there and you just heard that $1 million, well, probably more than that with all the money that's coming in.
$1 million. law.disorder.ar@gmail.com. One of the many ways you can reach us, contact us if we can help you help others.
Right. So that's kind of where we're at with this thing. And that's going to lead us into our guest today.
Yeah. Yeah. Our guest, Dan Yell, who works for the local CMH as a jail liaison, I believe. She'll tell us, she'll give us a little bit of clarity on that. But she's a therapist and she has years of experience in corrections. So you've worked with her.
Very close
in the jail. Yeah. For a couple of years now, right?
Yes. Yes.
I've gotten to know her recently through her involvement with Mental Health Corps, which is closely affiliated to Drug Corps. We're all board members on Families Against Narcotics, Lapeer chapter. So it'll be a good talk. I think it'll be a good conversation. We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll talk with Danielle.
Sounds like a winner.
All right. Thanks for listening. Come back.
stay with us. The Law and Disorder Podcast will be right back. Now, more of the Law and Disorder Podcast. Once again, here's Tim and Joe.
All right, welcome back. I'm Joel.
I'm Tim.
And we're with Law and Disorder. Today we have Danielle with us, and we'll let Danielle give you a little bit of her background and her what she does. Danielle?
Yes, I work for a community mental health, and I am a therapist and the law enforcement liaison for the agency. My background is I worked as a corrections officer for just over 4 years, and I've worked in the human service field, so I feel like the job that I currently have, I can use from both sides.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an interesting path. As you were a corrections officer, what made you think that going this route would be more fitting for you?
I can definitely say I enjoyed being a corrections officer, but in the end, I was doing what I'm doing now in a uniform. And I wanted to be able to help the people that I was seeing go through the criminal justice system and have them actually get better and receive the proper treatment instead of being lost in the system.
So we define the word corrections as actually correcting something, and you've seen that light, that opportunity, and you went for it, right? Because mm-hmm. we, as you know, it takes all types of personalities to make the correction system work. There's people like you, there's people who are straight by the book, and it's your fault you're here. You're going to do what we tell you, and end of the day, right? That's it. But yeah, it does take that extra type of personality to see, okay, we can't just create our own vicious cycle and then complain, right?
Correct.
So what were the types of problems you were seeing that you couldn't address in corrections, but you were better able to work on as a social worker?
I think with the substance use and the mental health disorders that were coming through, I know that a great deal, as I worked in the women's unit, a lot of stuff stemmed from the abuse that they received in their childhood that they never healed from, and they were continuing the pattern or starting new behaviors to kind of numb themselves to dealing with their past. So I feel by being able to help them get through what they went through and move forward and becoming a functioning member of society instead of a revolving door.
So would you say it's safe to assume that they are self-coping with these traumatic incidents from their childhood and whatnot? Because a lot of them are not aware of the services that your department offers.
I believe so, and I think that a lot of people don't want to admit what the underlying problem is, or they're not ready to deal with it. And there is the issue with, where do I go for services? Where do I start if you're not familiar with the system?
What are the services you have at your disposal right now that are most effective in helping people in this way?
I believe at our agency, what's most effective is that we do have a co-occurring disorder program. So we're able to target the two main causes of, you know, usually the legal system. So we tackle the mental health aspect, and we also deal with the substance use.
Because the two are almost always intertwined nowadays, right?
Correct.
What substances are people most struggling with nowadays, as far as you're aware of?
I think the opiates, alcohol, and meth are the pretty high rated, and I know that fentanyl is becoming used quite a bit more often.
Yeah.
Do you find people are knowingly using fentanyl, or are they still just getting it like by surprise when they think they're buying heroin?
I think a lot of people are knowingly seeking it out.
So they're just like, okay, I need heroin that's cut with
Yeah, and you know, I never did that. I never was like, hey, let me call my my guy with the fentanyl, but I would have. It just was never like said to me, hey, yo, I got that fentanyl, right? If they had, but you knowing knew. That I'd be playing a game of Russian roulette with about five bullets in the chamber, I'd have still done it.
Mm-hmm. But you knew.
I knew what was good,
right?
I knew when I was playing with my life.
Right.
But the thing that I never got into personally is meth, and I've heard that's on the rise. So I was curious. I wanted to hear if she would bring it up.
Right.
And she did. She being Danielle, I don't mean to be rude. I don't know if that is. I'm learning. But yeah, what percentage of people in the jail actually have a meth problem?
I would say it's a good split between the three of opiates, alcohol, and meth. I think if people are using some of the forms of medically assisted treatment, that meth is something a lot of them are turning to because those MATs don't work on the meth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's becoming cheaper than the other.
Well, so, we hear that all the time. Just a little background on the whole thing. Danielle and I run a Vivitrol orientation class every Friday. And we hear that often that, you know, hey, does this work for meth or does this work for that cocaine or whatever? And it's almost like they're searching for something that you can be on Vivitrol and still take and get high.
Absolutely. Some portion of those who receive Vivitrol have that mentality, because that's what being an addict is about. It's always having an angle, right, and looking for the means and the opportunity to do so. I'm sure there's also a significant part of the population of Vivitrol users, including myself, that are just happy that it's working for them and helping them to stay clean. But I would, based on what we know about how Vivitrol treats both heroin and alcohol, those being two of the big three, then maybe meth addiction is the hardest one to treat. What is that accurate or?
That I can't really speak to. I don't know, like I said, if people are just seeking it out because they know their form of MAT isn't going to work with it.
Right. So what kind of services do you offer? Let's say you come across an inmate consumer and they say they want help and they're incarcerated. So you give them the contacting information for community mental health. And what happens from there? Like, what is the process and what kind of services are offered?
So the process initially begins when they call the access line.
Okay, time out. I just want to add in there, this person is actively addicted to heroin. Okay, so that mm-hmm. person needs help. Now, I'm going to be that person, hypothetically, and you walk me through what's going to happen with my life.
This should be fun.
Yeah. All right, Danielle, go ahead and walk me through the process.
So if I'm sitting with you one-on-one and if we're in the jail doing this, I would make the access phone call with you. And what happens when you call access is you're giving to a clinician who will do your initial screening to see what services you're eligible within our county.
Eligible meaning... How is that determined?
Based on the information that you are relaying. Okay. So I always tell everybody that I meet with or give the number to access to that you have to be honest, and none of this information is used against you or used in the legal system. It's just to figure out how to best treat or where the best treatment can be provided.
Gotcha.
Addicts are not the most trusting people, nor the most trusted people. So that, given that this process has to begin with honesty on both sides, that's an immediate obstacle, an immediate hurdle.
Right.
Not one that can't be cleared, but...
Right. And I think if you truly want the treatment, you'll be honest.
I think it helps. I've noticed that when I actually sit down with the consumers and do the access phone call with them.
So peer pressure.
Not really peer pressure.
I've done the same thing. I've made access calls with people myself.
But I think it builds that trust with them as well, because I've met with numerous people in the jail and had them scheduled to come and meet me upon their release, which could have been a week or 2 weeks after I seen them in the jail, and they show up. So those are the ones, you know, that I know really do want the help and the treatment.
Sure.
So once we make that access phone call and they get a screening of a diagnosis, then we set them up with an intake, which is usually scheduled within the next 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come in and they meet with a clinician and do their intake, and then they get scheduled for a treatment plan, and then services begin.
So that treatment plan could include MATs?
Correct.
Okay.
It could be one of their goals or objectives is to obtain treatment. What I think is really beneficial at the community mental health that I am at, we have a health clinic attached that does offer the Vivitrol.
Yeah, that's good to have all under one roof.
Correct.
Yeah, so there's really...
Along with a pharmacy.
I was just going to say, a pharmacy.
Yep, and no excuse.
One-stop shopping for your...
Yep, no excuse.
Newly recovering addicts, which really, I mean, that I think is well planned. Whoever came up with that, I think it's smart to have that as easily accessible to people new in recovery as possible, because we're not the most organized thinkers, if you can't tell.
Right, and as we talked about before, a lot of people don't have vehicles. They don't have reliable transportation. So we have the bus system.
You don't have to make a million different
And races. That was my next thing, is the transportation is the biggest barrier to people receiving services. So I feel having all three of your medical, your mental health, and your pharmacy under one roof makes it extremely convenient.
Right. Not spread out across the county where you have to find it right here, find it right there. It's on different days. It's just coordinated.
And we do coordinate very well with the medical facility and our building to coordinate appointments around their medical appointments or their mental health appointments.
So I'm going to ask you a really, really tough question, and you probably weren't expecting this, but what's the solution to the opioid epidemic? In an ideal word,
in 10 words or less.
Yeah, no. In an ideal world, unlimited budget, you tell me, what is your idea off the top of your head based off of your experience and what you see on a daily basis?
Treatment.
Treatment as in what kind of treatment? We have
therapy.
We have MAT.
I think using a form of MAT, having a great support system, which could include therapists, peer recovery coaches, sponsors, just having a huge support system and accessibility to any services.
How do you feel? I recently read an article, and Tim and I have talked about this. As far as hospitals, do you think they need to be more involved when they receive somebody via ambulance that just overdosed, received Narcan, and actually made it to the hospital? Because as we know, they like to take off as soon as possible. But let's say someone does make it to the hospital. Do you feel that there should be more done in the way of detox, treatment, that type of thing?
I feel a lot of counties lack the resources for detox facilities or aftercare when somebody does come into a hospital or is brought via EMS. I definitely think more of a collaboration between the different entities and counties should be working with the hospitals to help seek treatment for these people if they're willing.
Mm-hmm. So would it be safe to say that you think the hospital should probably head that whole thing? Being as there's when the overdose happens, I mean, that's where they're going,
this
right?
is where it starts, right?
Yeah.
The local hospital doesn't have any kind of rehab per se, does it?
No.
Should it? Should we have a rehab locally? I know I kind of just ran all over that question, but I think it's... Hopefully I'm leading there.
I think it would be very beneficial to have something local, because most of the people in our county typically aren't getting their substances within this county because they're trying to hide it from family and friends. So by sending them out of county to maybe places that they were getting their substances from is very detrimental to moving them forward in recovery. And I do feel having more housing assistance, but I think that's something that every county struggles with statewide.
Yeah, I believe that. I do.
Do you have peers in other counties whom you've discussed different approaches with, how they do it in, say, the next county over versus how we're doing it here?
No, it's very difficult to do that county to county because every county surrounding here is so different. Population's different.
All the demographics are completely different.
Completely different. So what comes easy to other counties who have larger population, better demographics, like transportation's not a problem. And it comes down to who's residing in each county and what they're willing to allow into their communities.
That would make sense, I guess. I didn't think about it. It'd be very difficult for somebody from a county where transportation is prevalent to solve a problem where transportation isn't, as an example. But, you know, I still think we're talking about collaboration, so it might be useful in some way. Not that there's a silver bullet for every location.
Right. And I think everybody's trying to, whether it doesn't matter your location, your demographics, everybody's trying new things to make this work, the treatment. We can't just disregard it and say, okay, we don't have a public transportation system, or, you know, we're always looking for ways to do this. And that's why I wanted Danielle's opinion on, like, the best approach.
Well, and I can say, too, at our community mental health, we do offer bus tokens if people come to group.
Right.
So you come to group and you're guaranteed ticket, you know, bus tokens to get home and back to group next week. Mm-hmm. We offer meals at all of our groups because we know sometimes that might be the only meal that person is going to get that day, or the only healthy meal.
So there are additional struggles in treating people and getting them the help they need. There's those life stressors that we always talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And those aren't, if those aren't being satisfied or filled, then it's just an added stress point for them.
A few shows back, Joe, you had some statistics that reflective of the success of the Vivitrol program. Now, I know you didn't walk in here with some pie charts and bar graphs, Danielle, but is there any, like, concrete, hard data that you have that you could present as far as the effectiveness of these programs? And if not, then just anecdotal, what's your experience show you?
I don't have hard data on that. I can say that I've seen quite a few people become successful by using all of the resources that we have in this community and being open to it. I can say that I've seen people succeed and then come back. Life's not easy, and when things start going really well, I feel people think, okay, I'm done, life's great, and they kind of forget that life happens, and they didn't really prepare for some of the things to be able to cope with it.
Right.
They say, and everybody has their own take on this, but relapse is part of recovery. Others would argue and say that it in fact isn't part of recovery, but I know in my experience that a lot of people who are clean today had a few bumps in the road, and oftentimes they thought they had made it when in fact, like you said, they weren't prepared for whatever life threw their way. Frankly, that kind of scares me because I feel like I got this, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm hoping that I'm right this time. But yeah, I'm still putting on that coat of armor that hopefully will prepare me for whatever lies ahead.
I'm trying to honestly think of anybody that I know that has made it, like, went from addiction to recovery in one shot. Like, literally just said, okay, I'm done, went to rehab, therapy, counseling, whatever the case may be, and just kicked it and said, I'm good. I don't even know if that person exists. And if they do, definitely hit us up.
Leave us a voicemail,
because we want to know how you did it.
Right.
Right. So, Danielle, we have all this. We just discussed all this for the addict and those in recovery, and all that stuff is all good. What about family? So let's say you have a parent that finds out their child is addicted to heroin. They find out at the same time that they were stolen from. The kid's in financial distress. The kid has lost everything and burnt all bridges. What's there for them as far as treatment? Is there anything available, or do we just kind of let them kind of hang and learn along the way?
No, their process is the same. If we're speaking from a community mental health aspect, they may not qualify for services at community mental health because if that's the only issue that they're dealing with, that would be considered a mild mental health, and community mental health is severe mental health diagnosis to qualify, but they would be routed to other local entities to receive services. And then their services within the community, like FAN or Families Anonymous and things like that.
Right. So when you say qualify, that's basically hinging on whether they have Medicaid or not. Is that correct?
No.
No.
No, qualified is based off their diagnosis.
Give us an example of something that does make the cut and something that doesn't.
Right. Let's say I have like full-blown private insurance, health insurance. So I can walk in and say, okay, I have a problem. I get evaluated. And they're like, yep, you sure do, right? Yeah, you thought that was funny.
It's happened to me before. Right? So I'm just reflecting on personal experience.
Like, I think it's happened to all of us, right? You have a problem. Let's
see what we can do for you.
Yeah, so I have full-blown private insurance. I walk in, and you're telling me that I can get services there.
Yes, if you have a qualifying diagnosis.
Okay, perfect.
There is a process of that you would go through with billing that they would walk you through, and then once that's completed, your insurance.
Okay, because I believe that's a misconception out there that if you don't have Medicaid, you are not qualified for those services from community mental health. And that's one of those things that we kind of hit on before was, how is this advertised? Like, a lot of people don't realize, hey, these services are here whether you have insurance or not. And they tend to be like, well, there's no place in this little town for the, you know, for me to get help. My problem's bigger than this town, right? So where am I going
to
go?
Well, and sometimes it comes down to, you know, every situation's individual, and I don't do billing, so I can't speak greatly to that. I do know that, you know, you can pay fee for service, you know, and sometimes if they don't accept your insurance, then yeah, there you have to pay, you know, your copay or the fee that's allotted.
Okay, so your advice to a parent just finding out that their child is going through addiction would be to, you know, for services, local services, to contact your local community health.
Yes, they can contact community mental health. Or they can contact their local access line.
Okay, yeah. Just so that's clear, because I think a lot of people don't realize that.
And until you need these services, I feel like a lot of people don't know they exist.
Right. But when they do need them, now where do we find these resources?
Right.
Right.
So there's, you hear there's supposedly this giant pile of grant money out there for anybody who can type a sentence out. That might be an exaggeration, but I know there is grant money out there and a lot of programs are funded by it. Is there something you know that you would change if you could, if you just had the financial resources to do it, but you're otherwise held back by a budget?
I honestly would focus on the transportation. That's been the biggest issue with what I've seen with the consumers that I work with on a daily basis. I do know that there are some programs that we could run more efficient or even add our programs that we've had in the past based off of grants. But the problem is when the grant money is up, where does that funding come from to continue?
So on an average, let's say you have 10 people that come in looking for help and they're diagnosed the same. They go to the same, they're assigned to the same class or therapy session. What's the dropout rate on that?
I mean, I guess we would always say a third of the people who sign up will show up for like an orientation or a session.
Just a third.
And then maybe a third of those will actually continue with treatment.
Wow.
So a very small percentage are actually following through and getting the help.
So would you say some good, honest advice for a family member that is trying to help somebody with addiction would be not to give them money for a taxi or a bus, but rather go pick them up and drop them off?
Yeah, I would say provide that transportation if that's available. See if they're open to the person running group or the therapist that they're working with to have contact with their transportation person so they can be aware of the appointment.
So in a perfect world, our county And I know, you know, you and I deal a lot with this situation, so I already kind of have a heads up. But for our listeners, where would you rate our county as far as progress towards recovery, like helping addicts reach recovery?
I'm fairly new to the community, so it's hard for me to speak on that. But I can say in the couple of years that I've been working within this community that recovery is possible, and we've had...
Are you stealing our line?
No. Well, we don't own it.
We don't own it.
We can share it today since she's a guest on our show. That. Yeah, anytime.
But no, I think I've seen people in this community actually make a huge change. And when you actually sit down with them, they're still in shock themselves that they never thought they would be where they're at today.
Right.
I kind of feel that way from time to time.
For sure.
Maybe not so much right now. At any rate, I do. So there is a question I wanted to ask you, seeing as how we're both involved in specialty courts, right? But from a very different perspective, as I would be, I guess, a participant of, as the community rallies around me and tries to help me not get incarcerated or use drugs, so on and so forth. You have a very different role in such a court. What do you suppose you see differently than I do?
I think sometimes the choices as a specialty court team that we make aren't as clear to participants as being beneficial. I think some look at them more as a punishment. And really, we're just trying to do the best that we can to help the participants feel supported.
So you're trying to figure out who's going to embrace it and look at it as an opportunity and weed out the ones that are just going to look at it as a punishment they don't want any part of.
Honestly, I think most participants kind of begin the program as a way just to stay out of jail, because who wouldn't want to have their freedom and right. not be incarcerated?
Take that olive branch, for sure.
Education or incarceration, right? Choose.
And I mean, I feel that a lot of people usually within 2 to 8 weeks begin to want to participate in the services, that they're starting to see small changes, and that is giving them the motivation. I think when people have, you know, a stumble or a setback in their treatment or their recovery, they can kind of get discouraged, you know, knowing that with a specialty course, there are, rewards and there are sanctions. And they're individualized to each participant and their history and their needs and their treatment plans.
So I have an idea where Tim's going with this. So I'm just going to out Tim right now. So Tim was assigned to a parenting class and Tim's not very excited about this class. And he feels that with his responsibilities, and this is not, you know, yeah, I was kind of joking around at the beginning, but let's get serious for a minute. Okay. He's working a full-time job. Okay. He is involved with Families Against Narcotics now. And I don't know if you've made the drug court aware of that. I'm sure you have. Right?
Correct.
Okay. I mean, you're court ordered anyway.
But above, I'm court ordered to do it 2 hours a month.
Okay.
But I go above and beyond that.
Right. Okay. So your involvement with that, and then you do have your son every weekend?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Podcaster, columnist.
Right. So you have all these additional responsibilities. Now they throw this on you as to benefit your well-being.
It isn't where I was going with it, but now that we're here, it is like, yeah, like, so I didn't get this parenting class because I'm having a custody battle or because my son is having trouble in school. I feel like I got it in part.
A statistic, a number?
I feel like, yeah, I feel there are people that believe it is in my best interest because I have a preteen. However, I do not feel like I was ever asked my input on whether or not I would find this useful or perhaps something else to be. And I'm grateful for drug court. And I feel like I always got to kind of preface these sort of comments with the fact that I feel without the accountability drug court has given me, I would not be clean today. I'd either be out using, dead, or locked up.
And Barnes & Noble.
Or yeah, Barnes & Noble nodding out, probably. Yeah.
Reference our first.
If I was lucky. So I am grateful for drug court, but I sometimes I feel like I wish... The reason this is a topic is because you talked about it being sort of catered to the different individualized needs of the people who are involved in it. And for me, it doesn't always feel that way. I don't necessarily feel like...
They didn't evaluate your relationship with your son.
Well, I worked at a group home for kids for like 10 years with behavioral issues and, you know, emotional impairments. And like, it just like, I don't know. It's just another thing on my plate when really I feel like, why don't they see that really what I need is some time for me, some time to go to the gym, some time to watch like TV.
Like Netflix and chill.
Let me Netflix and chill all by myself, right? Like I need that. We all need that. Why don't they see that not only I need that, but I've earned that?
And my response to that would be, have you voiced that to your treatment provider?
I'm scared to. I'm scared to rock the boat. When I found out about this parenting class, I was told I was going to be a participant in it. There was never that I saw, it just got thrown at me. So I am actually like, I'm scared to do this right now. I'm just kind of.
So you want me to edit this out?
No, I don't want you to edit this out. No, I don't want you to edit this out. But like, I'm taking a leap of faith in doing it that whoever listens to it understands that it's well-intentioned and I'm not. And like I'm going to roll with it. I didn't want to do FAN. I was court ordered to do that. And it's turned out to be a very good thing. So I'm going into this as open-minded as possible.
Right.
But sometimes I feel like, man, this is just so much.
Well, I'm going to throw another perspective. And I see this from our side, the law enforcement side.
I would like to say that I'm glad that you're going into it with an open mind, but I'm going to backtrack to what I said earlier too. Like, the whole point of these specialty courts is to get you to stand back on your own two feet and to get your voice back and to start making choices that you feel are in your best interest. So to me, talking with your treatment provider and asking those questions, why was this added to my treatment goals? Why do you feel I need it? Because I may disagree, but maybe you see something that I don't. And there's a professional way to approach it. And then, you know, there's a not so nice way to approach
it. Right. And I would never do that. And the people who made that decision on my behalf, like, have mostly made wonderful decisions on my behalf. So I'm not going
to. Well, you almost have to trust them now that you made it this far.
Yeah. Yeah. There's truth in that. Like, definitely. So, like, I'm not saying I'm right about anything here. I'm just saying I'm expressing the way I feel. Like, when I heard about this class, I was like, sweet. I was like, God damn it. Like, another thing. Don't edit that out either, because that's how I felt.
Right.
That got thrown at me, and I was frustrated, and I was salty about it. If you can't tell, I'm still a little bit salty about it. I actually already attended the first class, and the...
No future wives.
No, man. Like, all right. I was looking for the bright side going in. Anyway, right. There are some wonderful people in there. But, I doubt I'll get yoked to any of them. At any rate, like the person, the facilitator of the group, man, I like her. She's very nice. And I see the value in the group for others. I'm still looking for it for myself. But
well, and you got to figure too. So if it's not something that can be changed and you're going to have to attend this class regardless.
For 10 weeks.
You can look at it as this is just another tool for your toolbox, whether it's going to help you in 5 years down the road with your own children.
I am trying to make more babies.
Or if it's going to be beneficial to maybe somebody's path that you cross, or maybe you being in this class is going to be beneficial to somebody else and you could be that light at the end of the tunnel for somebody in the class.
If you were being where you're at in mental health court and were involved in recommending the same class for somebody else and they came to you and said like, man, why you got this wrong? This is not what I need. Would you be receptive to that? Or would you be like, whoa, hold up. This is what I do. This is my job. You're like questioning, you know, you're just some addict in a courtroom. I'm trying to help you. You got a lot of nerve questioning my decisions. I'm a professional.
I think that goes back to where she said there's
trying to get the voice back.
Well, it's how you put it. Like, you can kind of explain
even that. If you came into my office with that mentality and that attitude, I would still be open and receptive to it, because that's the whole point of getting mental health and substance abuse treatment, is you are agreeing to your treatment plan. So it does become a different aspect when your treatment is court ordered. So there are certain parts of the program that are mandatory, but I can definitely say from the mental health aspect, we definitely have made changes and adjustments based on the individual's needs. So whether they need to focus more on individual treatment, so maybe they see a therapist twice a week instead of once a week in one group. And sometimes they start off with all groups and end with none. It really is individualized. And I think an explanation as to why a group might be added or changed is definitely in place.
And I think, Tim, you just need to buckle up and just get through it.
There's no choice. Like, it'll be fine. Right. Some other peer of mine in there got slammed with it, too. So, you know, misery loves company. We'll be cool. We'll get through it. But, and I do want to say, like, this is me and my podcast, so I'm just being honest. But I would never go talk to anybody in this sort of flippant way. Like, I would absolutely not only approach them personally.
No, but I think you honestly have every intention to attend. You still speak openly with your treatment provider and just ask those questions, because these are issues that you may come up with down the road in a job where your boss tells you you're going to do this and maybe that's not in your job description, or that wasn't on your schedule that day and somebody called in and now you're taking on their workload.
It is a strange thing to feel hamstrung by that, which helps me most, right? So I have no problem advocating for myself in a vacuum.
Well, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. You just had your first class. It's 10 weeks. What is it? One day a week?
One in.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll talk to you in a few weeks and see how you feel about it.
I'm going to feel the same way.
All right.
Well, with a mindset like that, then you definitely will feel the same way and not benefit from it if you can't have an open mind.
You're right. I have an open mind. I may feel differently. I don't feel that. Like, it'll be all right. Yeah. It'll be all right.
So, Daniel, just to kind of wrap up here on your end, would you say that one of the most important things for, whether it be city, county, state, the most important thing to look at when you're trying to develop treatment plans, would it be networking?
Definitely a lot of networking goes into it. Treatment plans are very difficult and encompass a lot. And it's not only what services that are going to be provided at the agency that you're receiving treatment, but could also include housing goals and dental and medical. So things that might not be offered in the agency that you're being treated at, but it will include the collaboration of other agencies in the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because one of the things that we see at the jail is pretty much when someone's released, and let's say they're from another county, we're not aware of what the treatment plans available are in that specific county. We have contact information and whatnot, but we do not know if we give them the Vivitrol injection 3 days before they are released, if they're going back to another county, are they going to be able to continue that? And that's where that transportation, that's where that where do I go comes in. So I believe that like that whole networking has to happen for it to be successful all the way around.
And I think that's something that we're in the works of doing. Mm-hmm. We do have somebody that does reach out and schedules those appointments for people who are not staying in county. Now, to get the data, if they actually follow through, mm-hmm. that goes above me.
Well, and I know our state of Michigan here, I received a survey from the state of Michigan, and it was very interesting to fill out. There was not enough characters. I type fast and I type a lot, but I also voice my opinion. So I ended up filling out this thing, and my answers were incomplete because I ran out of room. And at the end of the survey, it says, if you have additional information you'd like to submit or have any questions, please contact so-and-so. So that's what I did. I sent him an email and said, you know, first of all, I apologize for my long answers, but I'm not going to. You really need to extend the available space needed.
Yeah, do you want to hear what I want to say? No. So, but what I'm saying is when the surveys are short, like they're not, it's almost as if it's a perfunctory thing. They don't want to hear your opinion. They're just sending a form out.
No, that wasn't the case because that's what I originally thought, which okay. is usually, it really is usually the case. But these were in-depth questions about certain areas where I feel there's a deficit. So, and it had to do mainly with, obviously, corrections, MDOC, whatever. So anyway, I sent this email and I received one back, like, really quickly. And she may be listening. We go back and forth and I kind of gave her my experience and my track record and everything, kind of what I do in the communities in the way of addiction and recovery. And I mentioned the podcast, but she said, yep, thank you for the information. And then she said, by the way, what's the name of the podcast? And then I emailed her back and said, you know, hey, it's Law and Disorder, right? Look us up. Like, hey, girl. So long story short, she responded back that now this is a state of Michigan employee, right, in charge of conducting this survey. She said she's a recovering addict herself and would like to thank me for everything I do. Well, I thought that was spectacular because usually, you know, you get someone who has no clue, right? They may have an education, but to actually know what it's like, I was impressed. I was really impressed.
When will she be on the show?
I don't know if she's listening. She can drop us a voicemail and we'll get that linked up. And I'd really like to hear her take on some of these answers she's getting. You know, there's loopholes and they have to be closed, but it's a movement now. I think it's in motion and the state, the federal government, the state government, they're starting to move on it.
And we all have to realize too, anything that's coming through the federal or state government doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
Yeah. You know what? I think in this like continuum of care, I think we're making progress as far as how we're dealing with the quote unquote epidemic. Definitely. I think all these programs are a good thing. I think we're moving in the right direction, no doubt.
Absolutely. Well, Danielle, we'd like to thank you for being a guest today. We hope to hear from you again.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you very much. It's actually been cool to speak to somebody that's on a different side than me. In one area of my life, but...
Well, that's our goal, to bring all different
perspectives. Yeah, for me personally, this was cool, actually, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Law and Disorder Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes. Please follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or visit our website at ladpodcast.com. Recovery is possible.